Well, good morning. Welcome. Go ahead and open up to Exodus chapter 2. So, any of you remember Dan Hermes from Grace? Dan is the pastor at Darby Grace now, and he is a tent maker like us, in that he does a lot of contracting services throughout the week, but then he leads and pastors the church on the weekends. Of course, as we know, pastorship really kind of happens all throughout the week also. It's not just a Sunday morning thing. But he and I get together every once in a while because sometimes we'll talk about business, and sometimes we have projects that we're doing together. If we have a client that doesn't have a general contractor and needs some help remodeling, I try to refer him whenever possible. And so we got together to talk about a project this past week, and it was kind of neat getting together because we always spend about 30 minutes talking about business, and then it's like another 2 hours talking about theology. And he's really solid. He's a lot like us in terms of how he approaches the Word and his theology and his doctrine and everything else. But one of the things we talked about was what his sermon preparation looks like, and where does he find the time to do his preparation, and even just like style and format and things like that. And he said that he has kind of moved away from like writing everything out, has condensed his messages a little bit. They're still about the same length of time, but in terms of what he prepares. And he does it sort of day of, which I thought was kind of fascinating. And then we got to talking about like timing and the amount of verses that sometimes it takes to do a 50-minute or whatever. And he said, yeah. He goes, I have about 15 minutes per page. And then he said, and I always do my 3 points. And he said, and I always do the letters together. Or how was it? It's called like an alliteration. Is that what it's called? Or, and I said, you know, I don't really do that a whole lot. Michael does it occasionally. And so this morning, I actually am going to give it a try. We're going to have 3 P's this morning. So we're going to have 3 sections this morning that we're going to look at in Exodus chapter 2. And they're all going to start with P, all right? So we'll see how it goes. So go ahead, assuming you've opened up to Exodus chapter 2 already, I want to look at the end for just a moment. I'm not going to step on Michael's toes too much. What we're going to see next week is he's going to cover verses 23 through 25. But I just want to look at verse 24 for a second. It said, so God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And if you recall, when we began our study, we said there's sort of a handful of overarching themes that run throughout the book of Exodus. But one of the major themes that we're just going to see throughout the book of Exodus is this principle of God reminding Israel that he is their God and there are no other gods before him. It's a consistent theme that he's going to continue to remind his people throughout Exodus that he is their God and there are no other gods before him. And so Michael's going to have a great message next week just on verses 23 through 25 about God remembering his promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But this morning, what we're going to do is we're going to have 3 sections, and it's going to be all of the stuff preceding in chapter 2. Our first section is going to be about God's provision for Moses, and that's going to be verses 1 through 11. And you may say to yourself, wait a second here. Didn't Michael cover verses 1 through 10 last week? Yes, he did. I'm not going to undo anything he did. I'm not going to suppose to stomp on anything he did. I'm going to provide a slightly different perspective, and really our focus is going to be on verses 10 and 11 in that particular section. So our first section will be God's provision for Moses. Our second section will be God's protection for Moses, and that'll be verses 11 through 15. God's protection for Moses. Our third section will be God's preparation for Moses, and that's verse 16 through 22. God's preparation for Moses. So, what I'm considering here is that in chapter 2, some of the things that we might be seeing are God preparing Moses to be his deliverer. Now, what I want to be really, really clear about is that God has not called Moses to be a deliverer yet. We won't see that until chapter 3 at the burning bush. That's where the call comes. That's where the assignment comes. But I think we can reasonably say that God is preparing Moses for his call to be a deliverer. And hopefully you'll see that as we go through this text. So let's just look at verses 1 through 11. We'll do a high-level view until we get to 10 and 11. It says, "Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with pitch and tar. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, 'This is one of the Hebrews' children.' Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, 'Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you?' And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Go ahead.' So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Watch this. Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages.' So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses and said, 'Because I drew him out of the water.' Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked upon their hard labors." We'll stop there for a second. Last week, Michael shared with us this principle or this observation that God uses both the faithful and the unfaithful in part of his plans. And we saw that, how Moses' parents put Moses in the basket, in the Nile, very strategically. This isn't by happenstance. This wasn't random that Pharaoh's daughter just happened to go down there. They were very strategic in their faith, in trusting that God would take care of Moses. And isn't it interesting that the command, the edict, was to throw all the Hebrew boys where? Into the Nile. We could maybe kind of argue that even in their faith, they were somewhat obedient. This is what I have to do in life oftentimes with the building code. You know this, Chris. You know, we read the building code. Lawyers do it all the time. And you go, okay, what does the building code literally say? Okay, if it literally says this, but what's the spirit? What's the intent? You know? And it even reminds me of a political figure that who will remain unnamed who pose the question, what is the definition of is? Anybody remember that? Well, it depends on what the definition of is. I think it's neat that Moses' parents could go, well, technically we put him in the Nile. You said throw the baby boys in the Nile. We put our baby boy in the Nile. So anyway, I'm just saying. So I mentioned that the two statements that I want to kind of focus on in this section first here. Look at verse 9. "Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, 'Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I shall give you your wages.'" Not only was Moses' life spared, but his family got paid to take care of him. How many of us would have loved to have that as parents? That would have been very helpful for us. Here, you're going to get paid wages to care for your own child. That's quite a provision, isn't it? I mean, look at God providing, not just sparing the life, but providing to Moses' family for his growth. I mean, it just defies logic that God would do this and provide this financial benefit to this family. We've talked about types, right? We've talked about typologies. We've talked about how we have motifs in the Word of God where you'll see somebody who is like a type of Christ. He may not be the Christ, obviously, not the Messiah, but he represents traits or he foreshadows what Christ would come to do. Do you remember when Jesus was born? And Herod said that all of the baby boys 2 years and younger needed to be destroyed. And remember how the Magi came along and they brought gifts? What did those gifts help to do? Those gifts helped to, they helped to finance. Those gifts helped to finance the trip down to Egypt to save Jesus' life. And God provided. God gave provision to the Holy Family as preparation for sparing Jesus' life. I just think it's kind of a neat parallel that we have there. The second thing that I wanted to kind of see or look at here, in verse 10, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. And then part of verse 11, now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. Now, what's interesting here is that it says that Moses became her son. He was raised in the palace. Michael talked about this last week. He gave us a lot of the archaeological evidence for this. He was raised in the palace, in the family, under the roof of the most powerful leader in the world. Now think about that. Think about what he is exposed to. Think about the upbringing that he's got. Think about the education that he's going to have. Living under that roof in that palace. God is providing for Moses and giving him all kinds of education. Turn to Acts with me if you would. Keep your finger in Exodus chapter 2. Turn to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7, beginning in verse 20. So this is Stephen. Stephen is essentially rebuking his opponents, rebuking the Pharisees for their hardness of heart, their thick-headedness, for behaving just like their forefathers in the past, not recognizing part of God's plan, rejecting the Messiah. And Stephen says in verse 20, and it was at this time that Moses was born. And he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And after he had been exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. And Moses was, watch this, educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds. But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. So go ahead and go back to Exodus. But keep your finger in Acts. We're going to come back here a little bit later. But if we flip back to Exodus, what we see in between verses 9 and 10, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses and said, because I drew him out of the water. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up. In between verse 10 and 11 is 40 years. 40 years right there in between those two verses, because Stephen has told us in Acts that when Moses was about 40 years old, he had it in his heart, in his mind, to go out and visit his people. That's 40 years that God had allowed Moses to grow up in the most powerful house in the world. I mean, he probably learned about Egyptian government. He would have learned about Egyptian culture, society. He would have learned about military strategies, languages, arts, writing, mathematics. I mean, think about God's provision for Moses spending 40 years in an environment like that. You know, we want to provide for our kids the best we can, don't we? Don't we want for them to have as much available to them as possible? And here, Moses' family has Moses growing up in Pharaoh's house. And Stephen says that he's mighty in power and deeds, and he was learned in all of the ways of Egypt. And I would argue that these skills are going to be critical when you got to lead a million people out of Egypt. These skills are going to be critical when God calls you to take a census. These skills that Moses is acquiring and that God is providing to him in these 40 years growing up in Pharaoh's house are going to be critical when God calls you to judge disputes between his people. And so God is providing Moses with also, I would say, an authority and even an access to Pharaoh when it's time to go back. We're going to see this in the next couple of weeks when God finally says, all right, Moses, I want you to be my deliverer. I want you to go back and I want you to talk to Pharaoh. Well, Moses is able to just go in and have an audience with Pharaoh. That's because of this provision over 40 years that he has access to Pharaoh to go before him, the most powerful man in the world, and go, let my people go. So God's paving a way. He's making provision. I kind of wonder, have you ever looked at a season in your own life that as you were going through it, you didn't necessarily understand it, you didn't necessarily see all that God was doing it in it, but then you get away from it a little ways and you look back and you go, wow, God was providing for me back in that season. And here I am, I find myself walking in those provisions or using or accessing or leveraging those provisions that God had given to me. Is that anybody ever, right? So here God is providing for Moses as he develops his deliverer. Our second section this morning, God's protection of Moses. We'll look at the second half of verse 11 through 15. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, we talked about that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw that there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. And he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other, and he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said in return, "Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses was afraid and said, "Well, surely this matter has become known." And then when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now, first thing I want to have us notice here is that, remember, Moses is the author. Moses is the author of Exodus. And you notice what he does in verse 11? He repeats this term, brethren, a couple of times. Now, it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. I think he's doing that by design. I think that Moses is being very intentional about highlighting that these people who were experiencing hard labors that he had gone out to visit and look upon were his own. We're going to see again later in chapter 6, I think Michael may touch on it, but when we see a genealogy listed, one of the emphases might be giving that genealogy to reveal that Moses himself was a Hebrew and a Levite. Moses is seeking to identify for the reader that he's Hebrew at heart. Even though he's grown up for 40 years in the palace, and as Michael reminded us, there is archaeological evidence that there was this stranger, this foreigner, who had a very high position in Egyptian culture and Egyptian leadership. Even though that's the case, even though he can come and go, even though he's got authority and he's got a role in Egypt, high up, at heart, he's still Hebrew. And so he says two times that he went out to check on his brethren and he sees this Egyptian mistreating his brethren. And so I think he's reinforcing for us that's who he is. He's placing an emphasis on his Hebrew heritage. Now, Acts chapter 7, verse 23. Keep your finger in Exodus. I told you we'd be back here in Acts. Verse 23, Stephen says, "But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel." So Stephen tells us that this thought to visit his people had entered his mind. And a more literal translation there would render this as his heart. In other words, he felt compelled or moved in his heart to go see what I would call the affliction of the Hebrews. And so we'll flip back to Exodus now. And I'm just going to pose a question. Was this God stirring Moses' heart to go look upon his people? Maybe. We can't really say definitively. We can't say definitively that this was the hand of God supernaturally. The text doesn't tell us that God moved him or the Holy Spirit did this or that. But we could reasonably say, you know what, maybe God was stirring in his heart to go visit and look upon his people. I kind of lean on that side myself, but we can't say definitively. Maybe this is something he did regularly. The text doesn't tell us that this was a one-off. Maybe he went regularly to look upon his people and check on them and see how they were doing. We know that he was in a place of authority. He was high up in the Egyptian government. He lived in the palace. He would have known the condition of the Hebrews. He would have known what the environment was like. He would have been aware of how they were being treated. So maybe he went somewhat regularly. We don't know. Maybe, this is speculation, maybe he went thinking he might be able to influence or change. Who knows? But Stephen simply just tells us that when he was about 40, it came to his mind, or it entered his heart, to go visit and go look upon his people and their hard labors. He went there to check on their condition. And what happens when he gets there? Whether it's an isolated visit, whether he's been there many times, on this particular day, at this particular time, when he goes to visit and look upon his Hebrews, his hard-labored friends and brethren, what does he witness? He sees an Egyptian authority beating and mistreating one of his brethren. Verse 12 says, he saw this Egyptian beating the Hebrew, one of his brethren, so he looked this way and that. And when he saw there was no one around, he struck the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. So, kind of an interesting text there. Interesting tone. Moses tells us that he looks this way and that. Very calculated. He saw that there was no one around. He struck down the Egyptian and then he buries him in the sand. We don't know what exchange was taking place other than there was a strong mistreatment. We don't know if the Hebrews' life was at stake. We don't know if this was anger and righteous indignation welling up in Moses and he couldn't take it any longer. But what we can simply conclude is that he knew that he was going to run the risk that his Hebrew heritage, his Hebrew identity, was going to be exposed. He knew, because he had to look this way and that, he was very careful. He was looking to see if there's anybody around. He determined or ascertained that there wasn't anybody witnessing. And so he strikes this Egyptian and then he buries him in the sand. Can we say that this is sin? This is a conversation that Michael and I had. We can't say that this is sin. The Bible doesn't tell us that this is sin. The Bible doesn't tell us that Moses shouldn't have done this. What the Bible simply tells us is that this is the situation he found himself in, and this is what he did about this injustice. There was an injustice being performed and done to one of his brethren, and he comes to this man's rescue. He intervenes, and he deals with the situation. Now, just because We can't say, in this particular situation, is this outright sin? It doesn't mean that it isn't a practical reminder for us today, right? What did we learn in James? You're smiling. What did we learn in James? Quick to obey. Quick to listen. Slow to speak. Slow to wrath or anger, right? What does Ephesians remind us? In our anger, do not sin. Do not let your anger, even your righteous indignation, lead to a point where you sin. Jesus said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." And we've talked about how the definition of meekness is power under control, power under calculated restraint. Anybody part of athletics at any point in your life? You know, when you're in when you're in a sport where somebody has an opportunity to foul you or do something rather egregious, what's our instinct? Our instinct is to kind of get even or retaliate. I learned really quickly growing up, especially in soccer, referees, the easiest foul and infraction for them to identify is retaliation. When an opponent fouls you, whether it's caught or unseen, the easiest foul to then identify right afterwards is the retaliation. It's so obvious because they watch the player who was offended, and you can just see it. You can see it in the eyes. You can see it in the body language. You can see it in the general disposition. I remember one time when Rennie, it was totally random. This other girl just blasted this ball, and she was at point blank. Just smacks her in the face. I mean, it came fast, and there wasn't really anything you could do. It knocks her backwards. She's on the ground, and it was a good, good hit. I mean, the parents on both sides were like, ooh, you hear this big, you know, moan. So she's down for a minute. Her coach comes running over. Now, we didn't hear this. He had to tell us this later after the game. And he kneels down to ask her how she's doing and to check on her. And all she says to him is, "Who kicked it?" You remember that? Who kicked it? That's all she wants. I mean, she took a serious blow to the face. And all she wants to know is, who do I go after? And so I'm simply sharing this to remind us that here we have Moses, who sees this serious injustice taking place. And he comes to this Hebrew brethren's rescue. And that deliverance came in the form of him striking that Egyptian down. And oftentimes, you'll hear people say this was absolute sin on Moses' part. But the Bible doesn't tell us that it's sin. And I don't think we should take it that far. But I do think it's a good reminder for us, though, that as believers, as we walk and as we seek to represent God and be His ambassadors, we do have to be careful about seeking vengeance. We do have to be careful about retaliating. We do have to be careful about situations that we find ourselves in where we may be righteous indignation. We can see that there is a wrong and we want to right that situation, but we need to be careful. We need to be calculated, because it comes with consequences. And it had consequences for Moses. It says the next day, verse 13, the next day, then he went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" Now the NET says fellow Hebrew. Why are you striking your companion? Why are you striking your fellow Hebrew? Pretty reasonable concern. My people used to ask my brother and I how we got along so well. You know, not all brothers get along. Not all sisters get along. Some brothers just go at each other, right? Darren and I, we always got along. And I think, I don't know that we ever really spoke about it. I think maybe what we saw was more value in us uniting as a front against mom and dad than being divided. I think we saw ourselves as having a greater advantage by getting along with each other and being a united front against mom and dad than dividing our resources. And here you have Moses, the next day, after this Hebrew brethren is just getting beat by this Egyptian authority, and these two Hebrews are themselves fighting. Why are you guys doing this? He says. We have a common enemy. And here you are against your brother. It shouldn't be this way. Again, I think about James. Why do you use your tongue that way? Why do you use your tongue to glorify God and then cut your brother down, the very person made in the image of God? It shouldn't be this way. Moses says, why are you doing this? And look at their response in verse 14. Who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed that Egyptian? Uh-oh. I thought Moses looked this way and that. I thought Moses carefully made sure there wasn't anybody watching. I thought Moses got rid of the body and, kicked the sand over it fully. Uh-oh. It appears like there's now going to be consequences for what happened the day before. Keep your finger in Exodus. Turn back to Acts chapter 7. Hopefully you still have your finger in Acts chapter 7 too. Look at verse 24. Stephen says, and when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. We've talked about that, okay? And Moses supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they didn't understand. And on the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, men, you are brothers. Why are you injuring one another? But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday? Do you? Uh-oh. Let's go back to Exodus. Keep your finger in Acts, of course. So Stephen tells us that Moses assumed that his valiant act of killing the Egyptian would be recognized by these guys as their rescuer, their deliverance, their salvation. But they didn't see it that way. Instead, they look at him and they ask, who are you? I wonder, did they still see him as an Egyptian? I'm just proposing. I don't know. He was essentially known as an Egyptian, sort of, or his Hebrew heritage was suppressed, not made known. There was only a small few, Pharaoh's daughter, his family, that would have known. That's how he was able to come and go. I wonder, could these two Hebrews have still understood him to be an Egyptian? We see that when he flees to Midian, Jethro's daughters refer to him as an Egyptian. They think he's an Egyptian. Maybe that's part of the root. Maybe that's part of what's at their questioning. Who are you to be a prince or a ruler or a judge over us? I mean, he came and went from the palace and he was known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. Maybe that's all they knew about him. But either way, the point is that they didn't recognize him necessarily as their deliverer, Stephen says. So his cover has been blown. Look at verses 14 and 15. But the Hebrews said back to him, who made you a prince or a judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And then Moses was afraid. And he said, surely the matter has become known. And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. He sat down by a well. So I said this a second ago, but I'm going to propose that this killing was probably a pretty high-ranking Egyptian official, which probably upped the stakes. This killing also revealed Moses' Hebrew heritage among Egyptian leadership. This act now required Moses to essentially be a refugee. It says that Pharaoh tried to kill Moses as a result of this act. So it came with consequences. It now requires Moses to look over his shoulder. Now requires Moses to be very careful for the next day or two, or however long, how much time had passed between this event becoming known. But it gets all the way up to the highest official, and now he's got to flee. And so I said that our second section is all about God protecting Moses. He does it in a couple of ways. The first is that God's protection comes in the form of the Hebrews revealing that they knew what had happened. And you say, well, how is that protection? Well, Moses learned from the Hebrews that the matter was made known, that the matter was public. He didn't find out from Pharaoh. He found out the next day from the Hebrews, oh gosh, people saw what I did. So I think there's a protective element of that. It put Moses on alert that more people know about this than just he and that Egyptian that's in the ground. And so it gives him an opportunity to be safe, to go, uh-oh, this matter has surely become known, and now I'm going to have to be very careful. We could argue it gives him a head start on Pharaoh. The second thing that we see as part of this protection is this safe passage to Midian. Midian is about a 150-mile journey. It's super, super rough terrain. It's due east. And so not only did Pharaoh not catch Moses in Egypt, but we don't have any indication that Pharaoh pursued Moses to Midian either. And so we see God protecting Moses even in his escape, even in his mini exodus to flee from Pharaoh wanting his own life. And I don't know about you, but I'm going to say that I'm extremely grateful that God has protected me on so many different occasions. We were at dinner yesterday in Lima with two couples. We were visiting our friends, the Mikesells, who live over there. And we actually had a, you know how conversations go when you're at dinner and it's just, it's, you know, it's 4 hours of chatting. But part of the conversation included the kind of childhood that a couple of us grew up in and how we're so grateful and so thankful that God spared us. I mean, so many opportunities and so many chances that we could have had something extremely detrimental happen to us. Could have been physical, could have been life-threatening, whatever it may be. I am so grateful that the Lord has protected me to this present day standing before you. And I think you all probably have your own stories. Maybe it's in an automobile at one point. Maybe it was in athletics. Maybe it was on a ski slope. Wherever it may have been. Maybe a couple instances in your lives where you look back and you go, thank you for protecting me, Lord. Thank you for protecting me because I know that you have a purpose for my life. I know that you were protecting me then so that you could be using me now. And so we see God being merciful, graceful, and allowing Moses safe passage to Midian so that his life might be spared. Because God has a much bigger plan for Moses, doesn't he? So here's our third section. God's preparation of Moses, verses 16 through 22. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. Man, I thought three was hard. And they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to rule their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" So they said, "Hey, this handsome Egyptian guy delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew the water for us and watered the flock." And so their dad said, "Well, where is he then? Why is it that you have left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat." And Moses was willing to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. Then she gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." Did you notice what happened in verse 16 and 17? Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But these other shepherds come. So you have these seven shepherdesses who are given charge over their father's flock. They're out there in the fields, they're managing, and it's time to water these sheep. It's time to water this flock. And so they bring them to this well, and of course this was common, right? There would be many shepherds who would come to these centralized locations to water their flocks. And it appears that there's these guys who don't like these shepherdesses hanging around, and they're giving them trouble. Moses sees an injustice. Doesn't this sound familiar? Moses sees another injustice taking place. These shepherdesses are getting badgered by these guys, and so he comes to their defense. It says he drives them away. He stood up and he helped these women water their flock. And in verses 18 and 19, I love this, he's seen as a deliverer. Isn't that kind of what he had hoped would have been recognized by his Hebrew brethren when he struck down the Egyptian? Stephen told us that Moses had supposed, he had hoped, he had assumed that his Hebrew brethren would have understood that he was delivering them from that Egyptian authority. But they didn't. But here it says, when they came to rule their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon?" And their answer was, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds." Isn't that a neat contrast? Just in a couple of verses, we see, you know, how his action wasn't necessarily recognized, and then how his action was recognized. And he's seen as a deliverer by, we'll say, these Gentile Midianites. And the father says, this is Jethro, we know later, "Why have you come back so soon?" And so I would argue, I would propose that this was probably a regular thing for these poor shepherdesses. It was probably a regular activity or dynamic that they were probably bullied and pushed around. That when they would daily bring their flock to this well, that other shepherds there would sort of push them around, badger them, and they probably had to wait until everybody was gone, and then they had access to the water. They probably weren't able to do it very efficiently. And so every day, they would come back later and later. And their father says, "You've come back really early today. What gives? Why are you back so early?" And they get to say, "Well, great that you asked, Dad. Our day went really well today. Totally different like it's been all year. You know those guys that always push us around and don't let us get water for your sheep? Well, guess what? There was a guy there, an Egyptian, who went ahead and pushed those other guys away, and he not only drove them off and protected us, he actually got the water out for us. This guy was great." And so Dad says, "What's the matter with you? This guy actually draws the water for you, and you don't even invite him home?" Let me say, as a father of girls, that's like, wait, this guy came to your defense and he opens the car door? What's the matter with you? Have him over. Let's go. I mean, fathers want, more than anything, for a safe guy for their daughters' lives. Amen? You find a guy that opens the car door and protects your daughter? Let's go eat. Come on. Let's learn more about you. How can we keep you around? That's what Jethro's saying. He even drew the water for you guys. Well, go get him. Let's meet him. And so I mentioned that he's seen as their deliverer by their own admission. Isn't it interesting that Jesus said, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and his own house? Moses wanted to be recognized by his brethren as one who had come to their defense, and he wasn't. And he goes to this foreign country, and over here, he is seen as a righteous man. I mean, you know what I mean. And Jesus said that of himself. A prophet is not without honor except in his own country and his own house. Mark says that because of their unbelief, in other words, because of Jesus' families, his own brothers and sisters, because of their unbelief, Jesus didn't do miracles in Nazareth. John tells us that Jesus came to his own and his own didn't recognize or accept him. We may have that in our own lives. There may be times where you are in an environment and you are sitting across the table from somebody who you fully expect should recognize that you're operating and speaking on behalf of God and that person doesn't get it. Sometimes that's the dynamic that God has us navigate. And then you go, why can't I even preach and speak to my own family? But you can go evangelize and witness to a stranger over here who accepts Jesus in 5 minutes. Sometimes that's how it works. And so we see that Moses begins to dwell with Jethro. He takes Zipporah to be his wife. They have a son. And I think it's fascinating that Moses names his oldest son Gershom, meaning stranger, because he was a sojourner. Moses finds himself at a really unique intersection in life. He's not dwelling with his own people in Goshen. He's no longer living in favor with the Pharaoh as part of that family. He's over here in Midian with a third people group that's not his own. You want to talk about a test of resilience and fortitude? You want to talk about feeling lonely? Can't go home to his adopted mom. Can't go home to his own people. In a strange land, maybe 150 miles away, rough terrain. That's sojourning right there. And so he names his oldest son Gershom, reflecting that. Have you ever felt alone like this? Have you ever felt like you're in a space and you're like, man, I feel lonely and I just don't fit. I don't feel like I belong there. I don't feel like I belong here. And I find myself over here and I'm a stranger over here. God's preparing Moses. God's preparing Moses now for 40 years in Midian so that he can meet him in a burning bush and go, now's the time. And so I'm going to wrap up with these last few points here. Moses is going to spend 40 years in Midian where God will prepare him to be his deliverer. Now just think about this. Hopefully these resonate with you guys. God's going to prepare Moses by giving him a wife. We saw that. He takes Zipporah as a wife. And if you're married, you know there's a certain kind of love that is learned during marriage. You think, I know how to love. And then you get married. You go, I did not know how to love. There's a certain kind of patience that is learned during marriage. You think, I'm a pretty patient person. Then you get married. Oh gosh, apparently I was not a very patient person. God's going to use that when Moses is leading his people. How about this? God is preparing Moses by making him a father. Isn't there something about parenthood that changes your heart? You go, I know what unconditional love is. And then you have a child and you go, I didn't know what unconditional love is. It changes your perspective on life. Parenthood gives you a glimpse of, just a glimpse, because we can't love as God loves, but just a glimpse of how God loves us unconditionally. You think Moses is going to need that when he's leading God's people? I think so. God is going to prepare Moses by making him a shepherd. For 40 years, he's going to be dealing with sheep and flocks. Do you know how stubborn animals can be? People are like sheep. Jesus said this, so I'm going to say it. And they need leading. Jesus had compassion and sorrow when he looked over Israel and he said, they're like sheep without a shepherd. And so we know that sheep and people fall into traps. And we know that Moses is going to later refer to God's people as a stiff-necked, stubborn people. So do you think that God is preparing Moses to lead his people by having him be a shepherd for 40 years? I think so. How about this? God is preparing Moses by giving him a unique knowledge of the land. You know, they're going to wander for a while. You know, you need to know how to navigate terrain. 40 years being out in the wilderness is going to prepare you for another 40 years of being out in the wilderness. How about this? You know, it tells us in verse 16 that Jethro was a priest in Midian. You know that the name Reuel means friend of God? You know, we can't say definitively that he was known by Yahweh or that he knew Yahweh personally, but it's not out of the question. Could Moses have learned a little bit about Yahweh, or at the very least, learned about what it's like to be a priest and intercede on behalf of the people that you're leading? Do you think he's going to need to know how to intercede for God's people when he takes them out of Egypt? I think so. Moses is going to be called constantly to intercede for God's people. And maybe he learned some of that from his father-in-law. The last thing I'll share is that I believe God is probably going to prepare Moses to be a judge as well. And that partly comes through his father-in-law. You guys know that there's going to come a time after they leave Egypt where Moses is having to sit and he's having to hear and make rulings on the disputes of God's people. And he's having to judge rightly and justly. And there's a time where Jethro returns to him and goes, man, you can't do this on your own. You got to find help. You got to set up some sort of a system. Look at this friend that he gets in this father-in-law, this counsel. And so I'll close with this, that God is going to allow Moses to spend 40 years in Midian as he's preparing him to be the deliverer of his people. I don't know if this chapter 2 of Moses' life resonates with any of you. If you have looked back on your life and you go, boy, God sure did provide for me. He gave me a skill set when I didn't realize that he was doing this or that. He brought me up in a family, in a space, in a place, in a city, in an environment that I took for granted, but now I realize that gave me a launching platform or that gave me a starting point that brought me to where I'm at today. Maybe God has protected you along the way, where you can look at specific moments in life and go, man, that was nothing but the hand of God and his grace and his mercy on my life. And maybe you can say, wow, there was a season where God was preparing me so that I could walk, talk, and operate in the assignment that he's called me to that I'm doing right now. That's pretty cool. I didn't think I'd ever do this. I was just a BSF children's leader for a while, putting together 20 or 30 minute little snippets for kids. Then I spent some time meeting with him, end up having a homeless ministry downtown, and before you know it, standing here You go, okay. Provision, protection, preparation. Amen?